Blog Talk Radio.
Start it.
Johnny on the track.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started.
What is going on, everybody? This is another episode of Inside the Octagon, and I'm your host, Kalani Lua, and my co-host, Leo Showers, is on the line. Leo, what's going on, brother?
Hey, what's happening, Kalani? It's, man, fight week is upon us once again, and this time, it's International Fight Week. Seems like just yesterday we were dealing with the fiasco of UFC 200, and now here we are again 1 year later.
Yeah, man, time does fly, especially when you're having a good time and finishing out the year like 2016 was for UFC. It's like you said, it seems like only yesterday we were doing UFC 200 and all the drama that went with that. This year, not so much drama, but also not so much steak and potatoes, I guess you could say, for this one. Right now they're having open workouts down at the Park Theater here in Las Vegas, Nevada, but you know, the buzz around UFC 213 for International Fight Week, not what we're used to after the past couple of years. John Jones and Lesnar last year, the year before, Conor McGregor, Robbie Lawler. What do you make of International Fight Week not having the same buzz? What do you think that's attributed to?
Yeah, it seems like they trimmed a little bit of the fat this time around. And, you know, a few months ago, we were talking about 213 being this big card that they were building up. And little by little, things just kind of started falling off a little bit. And like we've been talking for the last couple of weeks, is that they've kind of been building up a curse over UFC Fight Week the last couple of years. And you know, once again, Amanda Nunes, you know, the front headliner for this big card on this big fight week. But there's really not a whole lot going on beneath that. I mean, we still got the Yoel Romero and Robert Whittaker fight, which is a fantastic interim title fight. But other than that, I mean, there's some hits and misses around in the card. It doesn't feel like that big event that we've been used to over the last couple of years.
No, you're certainly right about that, man. It certainly is struggling from the lack of star power. No George St. Pierre, no Brock Lesnar. For some reason, no Anderson Silva. No Conor McGregor, no Ronda Rousey, not that big marquee name we're used to having on these cards. John Jones in D.C., which last year was supposed to be on UFC 200, this year, instead of putting it on International Fight Week, they're going to put it at UFC 214. Do you think the purpose of putting Jones in D.C. after International Fight Week has something to do with the UFC being nervous that maybe for its big, quote-unquote, event of the year, John Jones would again have something come up where it would prevent them from having him in the main event? Do you think that has to play into it?
Well, Dana White was pretty vocal about that. I mean, the last few months or so, he was saying he was never going to trust John Jones again and put him in that big headlining type of marquee fight. And he just does not trust him enough to go through that again. And here we see him, you know, he's headlining UFC 214, and that's looking to be the biggest card of the year so far. I mean, that's absolutely stacked. 214 has basically become the new 213. And, you know, John Jones is still in that marquee headlining role, but it seems like they're shooting themselves in the foot by not really, you know, spreading out a little bit better and putting John Jones on International Fight Week. That's the guy that everybody really wants to see, and they're not really having him on this biggest card of the year, quote unquote. Instead, they're having him a month later when they could have just had him, you know, this coming weekend.
Well, I think, like you said, the UFC, Dana White, not trusting John Jones in that big main event spot. And I think one of the reasons we are seeing UFC 214 be such a stacked card, one of the most stacked cards in recent history or maybe of all time, is due to the fact that if something was to come up again and it prevented John Jones and DC from meeting once again, then you got plenty of ammunition left over for fans to look at and say, we're still interested in this. UFC 200 took a major hit when the John Jones news came out. Y'all ready to have Conor McGregor or Ronda Rousey on the card. Brock Lesnar being there really saved the day, even though that fight wasn't one that fans would definitely remember. But and then the drama afterwards with Lesnar and Jones. So it is certainly reasonable why the UFC would put such an amazing card together. But this week here in the desert, the fighters are here. The open workouts are going on, media day, and the Hall of Fame ceremony tomorrow. But before UFC 213, we have the Ultimate Fighter finale headlined by the fifth-ranked lightweight Michael Johnson welcoming in newcomer World Series of Fighting lightweight champion Justin – how you say that last name, Leo?
Justin Gaethje.
There you go, Justin Gaethje. And I got to tell you, I am very interested in this matchup right here. I was already interested just from a style standpoint, but now with the trash talk and the heated stare downs that's going on, Leo, what do you make of Johnson Gaethje?
Man, this is a really exciting fight. I mean, Justin Gaethje, he's just a fighter's fighter. I mean, he's already said, I know at some point I'm going to get knocked out in the UFC. And this is a guy who's just willing to take a punch to give a punch. I mean, what an exciting guy to watch. He's just an absolute fan favorite. And Michael Johnson's the guy who's going to go in there and stand up with him. So, man, I think we're going to see a barn burner right here and just fight of the night written all over that.
No, certainly. You got Michael Johnson who, he's 1-3 in his last four fights, but this is a man who holds victories over Tony Ferguson, Edson Barbosa. He went the distance with Nate Diaz. Even though he got clobbered by Khabib Nurmagomedov, I mean, granted, pretty much everyone else has as well. This is a guy who also knocked out Dustin Poirier. He was on a fantastic hot streak. He's got the punching power to go in there and end the night quickly. Gaethje, on the other hand, like you said, a puncher's puncher. He's willing to take one and give one, and he has certainly shown in his last four fights, all via finishes, that he's someone that's looking for the action, looking to end the fight, not leaving it in the judge's hands. So this is going to be a pretty interesting matchup, definitely one that should be fun. And I like it because the Ultimate Fighter finale sometimes, especially now because it's ran for so long, not everyone watches the Ultimate Fighter, especially religiously. So when we see guys from the show on the card, for a lot of fans, that's their first, maybe second time ever seeing these guys face off. Now, I know this particular Ultimate Fighter series was the comeback. So some of these guys, fans are very familiar with and others not so much. But to have an exciting matchup like this as the main event certainly shows that, hey, if you haven't been watching the show and you haven't been checking out Team Alpha Male crying every single week about TJ Dillashaw, you're in for a terrific main event. Main event here. I wanted to get your predictions. Who do you think is going to be the last man standing between Johnson and Gaethje? Are we going to see a finish, or are we going to see two strikers cancel each other out and actually go the distance?
Well, you got to figure, I mean, Justin Gaethje's got that knockout power. I mean, somebody's going to have to go down in this fight. And like I said, Johnson's a guy who's willing to stand there up against anybody. And, yeah, like you said, both of these guys are strikers. They're going to go in there and try to knock each other's heads off. I don't really see anybody going past the first or second round. And I like Justin Gaethje's chances. I think he's a little bit more of a crisp striker. And, I mean, unless he's got the octagon jitters going in, I really like his chances against Johnson.
One thing, Leo, me and you have noticed many times over is that whenever new fighters come to the UFC, regardless of what league they come from, generally more often than not, whatever division they fight in outside of the UFC, they now become the small guy in the division once they step into the UFC. If you're a middleweight, you come into the UFC, now you're one of the smallest middleweights. We've seen it on Dana White looking for a fight. Guys who he finds generally have to go down a weight class once they enter the UFC. Do you think Gaethje has the size to maintain his status in the lightweight division? Or is he maybe going to realize, as good as I am here in other organizations, I may need to move down to featherweight and test my luck there as opposed to being with the big boys in this rough, rough, rough meat grinder that is called the UFC lightweight division?
I mean, absolutely, the lightweight division is the most stacked in the UFC and in the world, really. I mean, that's really where a lot of these guys fall into their divisions. But at the same time, we're going through kind of a revolution in weight classes where we're seeing guys actually move up in weight classes because, these weight cuts are just brutal for them. And we just saw a couple weeks ago, Henan Barao, the California Athletic Commission, is refusing to license him because he just cuts too much weight. So now we're seeing guys fight at their more natural weight, and I actually see Justin Gaethje staying put because he looks like a very natural, lightweight fighter to me. So I think we're actually moving to an era where guys are going to start to move up or stay put instead of, you know, moving down and cutting drastic weight. And that's just really, you know, hindering their performances, hindering their careers. And, you know, we're just looking at these guys that are just so sucked in and debilitated by these weight cuts. I actually see these guys moving up in weight as we move forward.
As you speak, given what you just mentioned, Leo, the only fighter that really comes to mind right now is Jerry Hendricks, somebody who cuts an extreme amount of weight, and we've seen what toll it's taken over the years. Now, granted, USADA's also been involved during his time, during his skid, so maybe that's also been another reason as well, but the weight cutting is definitely an issue, and I do like the idea of fighters fighting more at their natural weight as opposed to cutting 30, 40 pounds, then bulking up 20, 30 pounds for the fight. You know, what's the point in us fighting at 170 if you're weighing 200 pounds the night of the fight? So this is going to be interesting to see where Gaethje comes because, as I said, sometimes when fighters come to UFC, we saw with Hector Lombard, he had to dabble a little bit to find, is middleweight where I want to stay? Is welterweight where I'm best suited? Ultimately, he went back to middleweight just because going down the extra 15 pounds are just brutal. Now, if they move that division up to 175, maybe he tries his luck back down there, but with his age, maybe not so much. Also on this card, I wanted to bring this up as well. Jessica Eye is going to be taking on a UFC newcomer, Aspen Ladd, who's a very, very, very entertaining fighter. Jessica Eye, though, she's a good fighter as far as you know she comes to fight, but she has had her struggles in the UFC. But she has also stated 135 is not her weight class. 125 is where she's best suited. For Jessica Eye, given the losses that she's had, Betch Gohara, Misha Tate, et cetera, if she suffers a loss this weekend, does the UFC get rid of her, or do they keep her around for another body in the 125-pound division to see if she could bounce back and show her true potential? What do you say?
Well, like you said, you know, UFC is getting ready to unveil this 125 division that's been a long time coming. And as far as we know, they really haven't signed anybody. They're just kind of looking to see if, you know, a lot of these women from 115 to 135 are going to move to this new division. And Jessica Eye is already a woman with a big name in the UFC. She's a really good talker. And, you know, things are just kind of falling her way in this long losing skid that she's had. But like you said, she's a very credible fighter. She already has a name with the fans. I think it would be smart for the UFC, you know, win, lose, or draw, to keep Jessica Eye in the division. A lot of that is also depending, of course, on how Jessica Eye is going to be looking this weekend. But, I mean, a lot of these losses, you know, they've been coming by decision. You know, her last loss against Tohea was against a split decision. So, you know, as long as she's looking relatively competitive in this fight, I see her moving down to this eventual 125-pound division.
I like Jessica. I think she's good for the division. She is an entertaining fighter as far as, like I said, you know she's going to come ready to fight. She's had some bad luck, and look, it's all about producing. But I do agree, with the new division, you got to have bodies. Just like we don't really see the UFC cut many women in the 135-pound division because they need bodies for it as the division continues to develop and grow. So for 125, I would definitely, definitely love to see how Jessica Eye looks there at that particular weight class if she figures it out more and can put things more together and be more consistent. On this card, though, you know, you're looking at the fight night, the Ultimate Fighter finale, you got Brad Tavares, you got Angela Hill, CB Dolloway, Ed Herman, Gary Maynard, Tisha Torres is kicking off the prelims cards on Fight Pass. Which fighter on the card that you could look at, without naming the guys from the show, which fighter are you looking forward to seeing an impressive performance from?
I mean, you mentioned two of those fights in the Fight Pass prelims. I mean, those are fights that should really be in the co-main event, really, because, you know, Gary Maynard and Tsuruto Ishihara. This guy, Tsuruto Ishihara, you know, he's been a really exciting prospect. You know, he's always talking about, you know, his bitches, you know, post-fight. And he's just a really entertaining guy to look at and really an exciting fighter to watch. So I really have my eye on that. And, of course, Tisha Torres going up against Juliana Lima. These are two top-ranked strawweights. And, you know, there could be title implications one or two fights down the line, especially if Torres wins. So those are the two fights that are I really have my eye on this weekend.
Yeah, most certainly. I like Brad Tavares, obviously the Polynesian connection, so I want to see him do well. I think he's a very good fighter. The inconsistency at times does bother me, but whether that's a matter of him just refocusing or getting with a better camp, we'll see. CB Dolloway, you know, this is a guy who at one point was about a fight or two away from potentially securing a number one contender's bout, but he's another one that has been able to put it together. I am interested in seeing Tisha Torres. This is a fighter who not that long ago, people were suggesting that she could be a top five fighter in the division, maybe even challenge for a title with the win or loss. But with the emergence of Rose Namajunas, you look at Michelle Waterson, Paige Van Zandt, and then you look at what's going on at 135. I wonder if Tisha Torres is going to stay where she's at or if she chooses to go to 125 and kind of try to find her way in that particular division. So I am curious about that. Now, moving on from the Ultimate Fighter finale, we got UFC 213, and this is a good card. It's not the card that we were hoping it was, but it's still a good card in my opinion. And it leads off with, his main evented by Amanda Nunes taking on Valentina Shevchenko for the second time. The champion Nunes looking to prove the first time wasn't a fluke and to secure her spot as the baddest 135er on the planet. Valentina looking to spoil those plans and show that the first time she was robbed. Leo, how do you see the main event playing out, brother?
Well, like, we've been talking about this fight for a few weeks now, and, man, that first fight was so close. I mean, it looked like a lopsided fight in the first couple of rounds for Amanda Nunes, and then somewhere in between the second round up until the end of the fight, Valentina was just showing so much heart and you know, just this grit to come back, and it made it really close, and it made it a really tough decision for the judges, and man, like, now we're getting five rounds, so you figure that momentum continues after the halfway through the fight. Valentina Shevchenko would have really won that fight. So I like Valentina, especially in the later rounds, and, impose that same game plan that she did in the second half of the first fight, just kind of counter-strike and then pick her spots and try to pick Amanda apart and then see if Amanda's game in terms of her gas tank.
Yeah, this is going to be I'm very curious to see how Amanda Nunes has worked on the cardio. She's such a powerful hitter, and we've seen time and time again, very good strikers, especially ones with knockout power, their cardio tends to fall fight goes on. We saw that with Robbie Lawler earlier in his career, but once he came back to the UFC, working at American Top Team where Amanda Nunes trained, his cardio got much, much better, and we saw that it led him to the title and defended it a few times before going down Tyrone Woodley. I like this matchup. I think it's a very good one, but I'm liking what I'm seeing from Amanda Nunes in her training videos is that she looks like she wants to focus more on maybe grappling a little bit more. That was a little bit where she had the upper hand over Valentina the first time around. Nunes, very good grappling on the ground with her jiu-jitsu. So if she could get Valentina, who's one of the best strikers out there standing up, she get on the ground, that's definitely thumbs up in her favor for the win. For Nunes, what worried me at first, Leo, was she kept saying, well, I already beat her. And I was just worried about that because, in a way, it reminded me of Luke Rockhold, Michael Bisping. Not the same scenario because Bisping was late notice, but Luke Rockhold kept saying, well, I already beat this guy. I already beat him. And then we saw what happened. I was very concerned that maybe Amanda Nunes could be overlooking her. Do you think there's any chance the champ, who has already, you know, beat Miesha Tate, knocked out Ronda Rousey, you think there's any chance she may be overlooking Shevchenko in this rematch?
I don't think so. I think Amanda's a very professional fighter. I think what she was going at was, it's kind of like going backwards, you know. It's kind of hard to beat a champion and then having to recycle people again so soon in your title run. But maybe she saw it as a step backwards and that, hey, I already did beat this girl. Like, you know, not necessarily convincingly. It was a really close fight, but she did beat her fair and square. I thought it was the right decision by the judges. But I don't think that she's looking past Valentina. I think she sees it as a credible opponent. And maybe she thought that there was a bigger fight out there for her, maybe a bigger name, like a Ronda Rousey or something like that. But, I don't think she's looking past her at all. I think she's very focused, and she's going to be ready for Valentina this weekend.
Well, I could guarantee you that even though it's a bigger name, Ronda Rousey would not be stepping back in that cage opposite Amanda Nunes in this lifetime or the next after what happened in UFC 207 or no
listen,
20.
All she needs is a little head movement and she's right there.
Yeah. Just a little head movement, just left to the right, and she's right. It's a completely different fight. You're saying, huh?
Yeah, you're right, man.
I obviously hoping to see Ronda Rousey back in the cage again. Hopefully, with a different camp that can really teach her some head movement, so to speak, and some other aspects of her game. For Amanda Nunes, yeah, you're right. Like I said, I was just concerned hearing that. But in watching the countdown, watching the embedded, I'm liking what I'm seeing more. And, of course, you know, with the cameras around and you know what it's for, you know, you might change up what you're saying just to be more cautious. But I am liking what I'm seeing in her training videos as far as what she's doing at the open workout today. She did do a lot of grappling with her girlfriend. So I know the guys out there are just, you know, being perverts listening, thinking of that picture, but I do like that in the sense that we could be potentially seeing a different side of Nunes in this one. If Nunes wins, this would be the second time she beat Valentino. Holly Holm just had a win, but she is 1-3 in her last four. Rousey's not around. Tate's not there. I mean, who's really there next for Amanda? Is there somebody that's on deck right now, or are we going to need a fight or two to determine who's the number one contender if Valentina can't be successful?
I mean, it's like you said, it's a kind of division, and you know, all the women are either coming off losses or just you know, they're already booked for fights. And really, the only one that's been impressive lately has been Holly Holm, and she has been coming out. She's coming off a 3-fight losing streak up against you know, top fighters up until last week when she won and looked really great. You know, I mean, the fight itself was not fantastic, but then she looked amazing with that switch kick on Betch Kohea. So that's the name on everybody's mind right now. I mean, it's either that or Kat Zingano, who's actually talking about moving up to 145 and possibly facing the winner of Tony Evinger and Chris Cyborg. So there's really not much else but Holly Holm and see what she can do against the champion after this coming weekend.
One name I have in mind is another person that is another fighter that Amanda Nunes has a victory over, and that's Jermaine Durandamy. She's on a 2-fight win streak within the division. She moved up to 145, beat Holly Holm via, you know, maybe controversial decision to some, but she won the title there. Now, you know, she's talked about now she's moving back down to 135. She gave up the belt because when Cyborg was willing to fight her, she said no mas. And now, you know, you have a champion, 3-fight winning streak coming back to the division. She's top 10 in the division at 135. Maybe you give Nunes and Durandamy, see if Durandamy can avenge her loss to Nunes. Also, like Raquel Pennington, who's ranked 5th right now. I looked at her schedule. I don't see a fight upcoming for her. So I say, given the fact that everyone else, Holly Holm, she does have a victory, but she was 0-3 before that. You got Juliana Pena coming off of a loss recently. Rousey's up in the air, but most likely she won't be coming back. Raquel's right there at number 5, and she seems like a logical option. She looked good in her last couple of bouts, retired the former champion Misha Tate last year in New York. So I say, if not Jermaine Durandamy, Raquel Pennington could be a good option for Nunes coming next. And then Shevchenko wins, well, the door is really open then for other possibilities. But I definitely say that women's 135 open, but it definitely has some competition as far as who can step up in the near future. Like you said, Kat Zingano, is she going to go up to 145 permanently, or is that just for a shot at Cyborg or Tonya Evinger? Or is she going to stay at 135 if she's given a title shot against a champion who she has a victory over? So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Excuse me. What if you're in the corner of Valentina Shevchenko, what's the game plan you're telling her to engage in to come out victorious so that it doesn't go the other way like it did last time when these two first met up?
Well, it's kind of a tailor-made fight for her because Amanda Nunes is you know, really that bull rusher. She wants to go in there and just kind of knock your head off. And Valentina is made for, you know, that backpedaling style, and she's going to choose her spots and choose openings. So I think she's going to try to look for an opening from Nunes. I don't think she wants to go up against the cage against the champion because Amanda, you know, like you said, her grappling is absolutely incredible. Although in Valentina's last fight, we saw her, you know, do pretty well in the grappling department against Juliana Pena, who's a very good wrestler herself. But I'd really like to see Valentina, you know, try to stay in the middle of the cage, you know, use her backpedaling to pick her spots against Amanda Nunes and try to pick her apart, much like she did in the last couple of rounds in the first fight.
Very good point indeed. For Valentina, obviously the key to success for her is to keep this fight standing. She keeps this fight standing, it definitely will help favor her. Now it's not going to mean she has the overall upper hand on Nunes in a stand-up game, not at all, but it will definitely favor her a little bit more. She throws in a nice combination of not only punches but kicks as well, different variations, head kick, spinning back kick, roundhouse kick. So it's going to be very interesting to see who can implement their game plan more, who can impose their will on their opponent more. Will Nunes be able to use her size, power, and grappling ability, or will Cervenka be able to be elusive, move around, movement, and combinations to keep the champ at bay? It's certainly going to be one of interest to see how these two ladies go at it for the second time. We might just see these two go out there and have a Forrest Griffin, Stephen Bonner moment, meet in the middle of the ring and just slug it out, given all the hatred between them leading into this fight. It's going to be fun to check this out. What's also going to be fun, Leo, the main event. Talk to us about the main event. The co-main event. Talk to us about the co-main event, because I got to tell you, this is one I got a big star next to. I'm excited for it.
Yeah, what a hell of a consolation prize they gave us, you know, when the fight or when the card started to fall through, you know, we weren't going to see a Bisping versus GSP. And then we get Romero versus Whitaker for an interim title. Just absolutely an incredible fight. Two number one guys going up for an eventual title shot against Michael Bisping at this point. And I'm really excited like you are. And, you know, we've seen Robert Whitaker. He's been looking amazing his last few fights. And then Yoel Romero, he's just been tearing through that division. So I'm really excited to see this as well.
I am excited to see what God and Jesus has in plan for the soldier of God, Yoel Romero. 40 years old, this guy looks like a freaking tank. He literally looks like he could go from the octagon, go to the Olympic trials, make the national team, compete for a gold medal, and then end up on a bodybuilding competition stage and play somewhere pretty decently from the waist up. He's a freak athlete, truly yeah, one of the most fascinating specimens we've ever seen in the cage. But his opponent, Robert Whitaker, coming from down under in Australia, he's got an aggression and he's got some power that, you know, it's not like we've never seen it before, but he's got a good combination to where you say, you know, Romero's nice, but we've seen him struggle against strikers. We saw against Tim Kennedy. Kennedy was able to land some pretty good shots on him. Weidman, even though Weidman was mixing up the wrestling, you know, we've seen Romero struggle with guys who are a little quicker than him. Whitaker obviously is going to have that speed, but Romero's got that closing speed. We've seen that flying knee a couple times. How do you, if you're in Whitaker's corner and you're standing across from the Olympic silver medalist, somebody that looks like the Terminator who has God on his side, what is your game plan for Whitaker to go in there and try to be successful against the number one ranked middleweight?
Man, if you're Whitaker, you just got to go in there and be Whitaker. You have to pick your spots. You have to, you know, use your footwork to go around this beast of a man that's right in front of you. So I like Whitaker to, you know, try to set up some combinations and try to pick Yoel Romero apart. And we've seen Yoel just kind of gas out in the middle of fights. And this is a five rounder. I don't think we've ever seen Romero in the fifth round or even in the fourth round. So, Like I said, we've seen this guy kind of gas out towards the end of the fight. So I like Romero to kind of pick his spots a little bit and turn it up as the fight goes on. And I like Whitaker to, you know, to take it in the championship rounds.
Leo, what do you see as the biggest gap advantage? Romero's grappling ability or Whitaker's striking power and ability? What's the biggest gap difference to you out of those two?
I mean, Yoel Romero, absolutely an Olympic level of grappling, and you know, Whitaker, you know, an amazing striker himself, but man, how do you deal with that incredible wrestling that Yoel Romero has been imposing on so many of these guys over the last few years? And I mean, on top of that, he's got that vicious right hand. He's got the flying knees, like you say. He's got a pretty decent package along with that incredible wrestling. So I think in terms of the gap, I think Romero has a bigger advantage, although every fight starts on the feet. So he's going to have to do something to take Whitaker down. He's going to have to catch him first. So I think Whitaker's going to really try to use the footwork in the first couple of rounds up until he sees Romero fading a little bit.
What I'm starting to see that could happen is while they're standing up, Whitaker could be, you know, circling around, you know, trying to look for an opening. Romero's coming forward, hands out, throwing a kick. And I could just see he either faints or throws, you know, a lazy jab or just throws a punch out there. And Whitaker slips it and fires away a big right hand that lands on Romero, shakes him up. And we've seen what Whitaker can do once he hurts you. He's a shark in the water that smells blood. He jumps on you so quick and so fast. Ask Jacare about it. And given the fact that, yes, Romero is a tremendous grappler, he's not a jiu-jitsu specialist. He's not someone who gets on his back and you want to stay away like Jacare. So I can see Romero being stung and hurt by Whitaker's stand-up. But with that, when Whitaker comes in, is he going to be able to keep himself composed enough to where he doesn't allow Romero to grab his legs or his waist and take him down and get control? From there, you know, that could spell danger for Whitaker if he allows Romero to get a good hold on him and take him down. I don't know where to go in this one as far as who to root for. I'm a big, big Yoel Romero fan. I do remember him watching in the Olympics at the time. Obviously didn't know who he was, but I was like, whoa, this guy is amazing. He's arguably one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. So that just shows you how good of an athlete he is. And at 40 years old, to be in a matchup for the interim title, it is tremendous. Now, the winner of this, according to Dana White, is going to get the shot at Michael Bisping next. Not George St. Pierre, not Anderson Silva, not Luke Rockhold. The winner of Romero Whitaker is going to be taking on Michael Bisping, who, according to Dana White, again, has never turned down a fight. He's recovering from knee surgery that he had in late April. Out of these two, Leo, who benefits Michael Bisping more matchup-wise? Who would be a better matchup for Bisping out of Whitaker and Romero?
I think the easy answer here would be Whitaker, because he's a guy who's going to go in there and try to stand against Michael Bisping as opposed to try to put him on his back and really not do much else after that. He's just going to put him on his back and maybe ground and pound him a little bit. Whitaker's a guy who's going to stand in there against Bisping, and I think that's what Bisping wants at this point in his career, just kind of stand there and try to pick spots and not really do too much of the grappling. But man, Romero, he cut out that amazing promo at UFC 205 calling out Michael Bisping. Michael Bisping giving him both fingers. I mean, there's already a storyline built between these two guys that's been brewing for the last, I don't know, year or so. So, you know, as far as a marquee matchup, I think the Romero fight would probably be a bigger attraction for the fans for, you know, between him and Bisping. But Robert Whitaker would probably be a better styles matchup. So I guess Michael Bisping, you know, really has a win-win, if you will, between these two fighters. He really can't lose. He did lose out on the GSP fight. That was a big money fight for him. But if it's going to be between these two guys, I think both are interesting fights for him.
I tend to lean towards the Romero side just a little bit more, simply for this alone fact. Bisping, as you said, Leo, when you were breaking down Whitaker, he's very good at footwork, moving around, getting in and out with his strikes. He's not someone that's going to, you know, outside the Luke Rockhold fight, he's not a one-punch power-type puncher. He's a volume striker. So he's somebody that I see with his footwork and his movement and his terrific cardio be able to move around, keep Romero on the outside, and not allow Romero to get off a flying knee or to utilize his wrestling. If he was to take on Whitaker, I think it'll be a good matchup. It'll be fun. But we've seen Bisping hasn't done too well with power strikers. We've seen him against Vitor. We've seen him against the first time with Rocco and others. And Dan Henderson,
he was even put in trouble by Anderson Silva in that fight in February of last year.
Yeah, no, exactly. Very good point. So even though Romero has tremendous power, Romero is more of a I'm looking to explode on you type power. Where Whitaker, you know, he'll throw a little bit more volume punches, and when he lands on you, it is a thud. So I would definitely think Romero just right now is a better matchup. Neither one is going to be easy, I can tell you that. But I am definitely looking forward to this interim title fight between Yoel Romero and Robert Whitaker. Now, unfortunately, we don't have Robbie Lawler and Donald Cerrone on this card. That's going to be at 214. But we do have a pretty interesting heavyweight matchup. Fabricio Werdum, Alistair Overeem. They're going at it again. These are two former Pride guys, Strikeforce guys. A tremendous grappler in Werdum, a tremendous striker in Overeem. Who do you see coming out in this heavyweight matchup? Werdum with the crazy face or Overeem with the alligator meat?
Well, I mean, if we remember the last time around these guys fought, it was kind of a dud. And that was because Werdum just kind of was flopping around. He was waiting for Overeem to get in his guard, and Overeem just refused. So, man, it was just a weird fight to see in Strikeforce back in the day. But ever since then, Werdum has been more confident in letting his hands go a little bit, and his striking has improved vastly since that fight. And obviously, you know, he's one of the best jiu-jitsu fighters in the UFC right now, especially at the heavyweight division. So I kind of see Fabricio trying a little bit more. Maybe he was caught up in that K1 Alistair Overeem that he just didn't want to stand up against him. But I see him being a little bit more confident now in his stand-up game, to maybe want to trade a little bit more with Overeem, you know, don't go too crazy and, you know, get caught, but try to stand a little bit more and grapple him down instead of flopping and waiting for Overeem to get in his guard. So hopefully this will be a much more entertaining fight. Both of these guys, you know, they're already calling for rematches against Stipe Miocic. Each of them is coming off a single victory. So, you know, it might be a little bit of a hard road up there for both of these guys, but, if Fabricio Werdum is a little bit more disciplined in his game plan, I think this fight could be a really entertaining fight.
This is a rivalry that expanded back to Pride Total Elimination Absolute of May of 2006. That's when Werdum got the first victory over him via submission. Then, as you said, they fought again in Strikeforce, which at the time was really looked at to be a tremendous fight. Overeem was this monster heavyweight who was just on a tear throughout the division across the world. Werdum couldn't have been any hotter, given that he just put off the ultimate upset over Fedor. But then they fight, and yeah, you know, Werdum knew he had to stay. He knew he had the upper hand in the ground game. Excuse me, now I lost my train of thought. But he knew that he could take it to the ground and be terrific. And Overeem was like, "Yeah, I'm not playing that game." Now that Verdun's gotten a little more confident in his stand up, working down there at King's MMA, he's looked a little bit more confident. His submission is still on par. Overeem, not as big as he was before, still got tremendous power. But we have seen that if Overeem gets out the first round, you know, he's still suspect then to get finished, even with his jaw. So this is going to be an interesting matchup. I don't think it's going to be a necessarily fight of the night, but I am curious to see how both will attack each other. Werdum look to get in, maybe stand up a little bit with Overeem and then take him down? Or is he going to be so cautious of Overeem's striking power, he's going to play it safe and try to wait for Overeem to overcommit, take him to the ground, and go from there? And then for Overeem, are we going to see the one that kind of just stands in the middle of the cage, hunts you down, but isn't really aggressive with his strikes because he's cautious of the ground game? Or is he going to come out saying, if I want a heavyweight title shot, I need to go out there and I need to fire away and get a vicious knockout, or at least give me a number one contender's bout for the title shot later this year? So I'm interested to see how this trilogy fight between these two heavyweights go. It's going to be fun, and I am interested to see, will Werdum hit the troll face, or will he save that for afterwards if he's victorious? Now,
well, I mean, he certainly built as far as the face, he certainly built a brand behind it. I mean, the fans are really relating to him because of that funny face that he's making, and it kind of backfired, you know, when he lost to Stipe Miocic. But hey, man, you got to do what you got to do to get recognized.
You do, and you know, that's the downside of self-promoting. Is when you try to go out there and promote yourself, capitalize on your recent fame, what about you is popular, that if you lose, then, hey, it backfires on you. And we've seen it time and time again, Leo. Making a title defense, especially in your backyard, it is very tough to fight in front of your home crowd. It is not an easy thing to go in there as the favorite because everyone's telling you you're the best, you're the greatest, you got this. And you know, like the famous boxer Marvin Hagler said, it's very hard to go out there and train as intense as you need to when you're waking up in silk sheets. So for Verdum, you know, he definitely let the moment get to him. We've seen Stipe take advantage of it in Ohio against Overeem. It is going to be interesting to see who comes out on this one. I don't think either one with a victory is going to be next in line for a title shot, but I definitely think that they can be possibly one more fight away if this is an impressive victory for a number one contender's bout in the near future. I definitely see that. Would you concur?
Well, like you said, if it's an impressive victory – man, one big highlight finish can do wonders for you and propel you to that top of that division. So, yeah, if it's a dud of a fight like it was last time around, then it's kind of hard to make a case for either guy to get a title shot, especially because they both were finished in the first round in their championship fights against Stipe. But if there's, you know, a very impressive performance by either one of these guys, or kind of doubted that it's going to be like a fight of the night, but if it's something along those lines, it's kind of easy to just give one of the two guys a nod.
Yeah, definitely. So this is going to be interesting to see not only how this fight plays out, but where the winner goes from here. But let me ask you this real quick before you move on: if Overeem loses, or the loser rather, how far down the heavyweight title rank do they fall? Do they take a dramatic fall? Or given their name, their status, and, well, let's be honest, the heavyweight division not necessarily having a ton of guys who are on fire right now, do they only fall down a few pegs to where they're still not going to be that far removed for a potential title shot in the future? What do you think?
I think, again, it all goes down to how each of these guys looks. I mean, we've seen Overeem being knocked out, you know, so many times in his career, and he always seems to bounce back a little bit and just kind of, you know, stay at the top of that division. You know, if he gets brutally knocked out, I mean, that would just be devastating for him. But like you said, it's not the most stacked of division. So I don't think a loss, or just a regular old decision loss or anything like that would be the end of the world for either guy. But, you know, if they don't really look up to performance, then yeah, that might, you know, shoot him down the rankings where they may never see another title shot again.
Yeah, definitely. So this is going to be something that both fighters need to make sure. Even if for whoever loses, they need to at least make sure that their performance is good enough to say, even though we lost, hopefully we don't fall that far down the rankings because of how we looked in this performance. Now, Leo, speaking of looking at his performance, former lightweight champion Anthony Showtime Pettis is returning back to the division he once was king of. But he is far from his old days of being Showtime. Now it is almost no time. Pettis is taking on a very tough and game veteran in Jim Miller. What has happened to Anthony Pettis? I mean, were the Wheaties that bad? I mean, I know nobody eats them, but were they that bad that they've made this former champion look as if, man, is he about to get cut from the promotion?
Man, it's kind of been a sad story of Anthony Pettis because he looked like this absolute world beater, like this unbeatable lightweight champion, and then he runs into Rafael Dos Anjos and just goes on a crazy losing streak. And, you know, he tried his luck at featherweight. It really didn't work out for him, especially against Max Holloway. I mean, he was struggling with the weight issues, and now he's realizing, you know, 155 is probably his better division. Don't worry so much about weight cutting and try to focus on game planning and just kind of, you know, right the ship again. I do think he still has another title run left in him, and it's going to start here against Jim Miller, like you said, a very game opponent. And I kind of like that the UFC is challenging him a little bit here because what we've seen Anthony Pettis struggle against a lot in his UFC career is against grapplers. I mean, we first saw that against Clay Guida, where who would have thought Clay Guida was going to make Anthony Pettis look, you know, basically amateurish in the grappling department. But I think he learned a lot from that fight. And he's looked a lot better in his grappling. His offensive jiu-jitsu is very good. So I like Jim Miller to challenge Anthony Pettis and see if Pettis can right the ship here.
You know, there is people, there is whispers going around that, hey, did you notice Anthony Pettis started not looking so good once USADA got involved with the UFC? Again, not trying to insinuate anything, but I'm just saying, you look at Johnny Hendricks, you look at Pettis, it's ironic that some of these fighters look like world beaters, and then once USADA says, hey, we need a sample, now you're starting to see them physically not look the same in the body. Performance-wise, they're certainly far from what they once were. For Pettis, he's a tremendous fighter, very marketable, but like you said, it's very sad to see what has happened to him over his career. 1-4 in his last fights. Max Holloway just had a fantastic performance against him. He's returning back to a division that he finished out 0-3 before trying his luck at 145, and I don't know if Jim Miller's the right guy to match him up with. He's a game opponent, Jim Miller is. Very scrappy. He's one of the toughest guys there. Unfortunately, he's another one that's never been consistent enough to put together a title run. But he is somebody that is in the middle of that. He's kind of like Tim Boach. He's that guy in the middle that you just when you think he's going to be a doorstep for somebody or a gatekeeper, he goes out there and shows you he's anything but and gets a victory. So this is going to be a good one for both. I think Pettis, if he can find that consistency, and whether that's him training more down at Greg Jackson in Albuquerque or just finding the focus to go out there and put on a tremendous show, I think we could see a left high kick to finish off Jim Miller, and maybe we see Anthony Pettis get back on that the track of being Showtime once again. Can he make a title run? Sure, but in this division, I don't know. Let me ask you this. Does Pettis maybe need to try his luck at welterweight? We've seen RDA, Rafael Dos Anjos, go up there. We've seen Donald Cowboy Cerrone go up there, and they're having success. Should Pettis maybe consider going up to 170, or is he just too small?
I think he might just be a little bit too small. I mean, a lot of people, by all accounts, they say that Pettis walks around in like the 190s, maybe even 200 pounds or something like that. So maybe he's not necessarily too small for welterweight, but I mean, this is a guy who's found success. He's been a champion at 155. I think it might be a little bit too soon for him to start thinking about, you know, skipping, yet another division. I think he might want to focus on trying to make another run at this lightweight and see where everything goes from there. You know, just give it one more go at lightweight, and then before you think about, you know, going up against these bigger, stronger guys.
Anthony Pettis stands at 5'9", and like you said, if he does walk around close to 190, 200 pounds, that would certainly put him in line at welterweight. Rafael Dos Anjos is 5'8", Cerrone 6 foot. So I would personally just like to see the Anthony Pettis of old. Now, the wins and losses, I don't necessarily mind, but it's the performance overall. I haven't seen a performance from Anthony Pettis since 2014 at UFC 181. That I said, wow, that guy is amazing. All of his losses, even his win over Charles Oliveira at 145 in his debut, I wasn't that impressive by just the overall performance. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how he performs back at 155. And who knows, maybe a move up to another division is in his future. If thing doesn't work out here, he's 30 years old, so he still's got time. The main event of the prelim cards on Fox Sports 1, Travis Browning taking on Go ahead and help me out with that, Leo.
I think I might have to throw a white flag on this one, but it looks like Oleski Oleinik.
Well, you're a lot closer than I would have been for it, that's for sure. Now, Travis Browning, obviously, he's had his own troubles in and outside the Octagon, but there is some silver lining in it. The report of Ronda Rousey saying how Travis Browning helped her find some thieves that broke into her house, robbed her of some things, especially her Olympic rings, called the authorities, and they were caught. So good Samaritan move by Travis Browning there. But now he's got to step in the cage, and I got to tell you, what has happened to this guy, Leo? At one point in time, this was Hopper Brown. This was a guy that was knocking people out. He was going to be one of the new wave of the heavyweights, tall, lean, athletic, tremendous power. And then, crashed and burned horribly. Can Travis Browning bounce back, or is this on the last leg and Olenek here is going to use him as a stepping stone to promote himself up the ranks?
Yeah, like you said, Travis Brown was a guy who was, man, he was like a championship caliber fighter. He was an amazing streak. I mean, to me, I mean, he arrived when he beat Alistair Overeem by that crazy front kick, and ever since then, I mean, he's kind of been up and down a little bit. And, you know, when he moved to the Glendale Fight Club, that's really when we started to see a decline in his career. I think he was doing really good at Greg Jackson's camp, and you know, he made a change. I don't think it was the right move for his career, and we've seen the results of it. I mean, he's really not looked consistent at all, and now he's sitting here just kind of fighting an up and coming guy, and basically fighting for his career. So I think Travis Brown's back is really up against the wall. He's really going to need a victory here to try to maybe fight himself back up in the rankings.
You know, given the nature of the heavyweight division, I don't believe that he'll be cut with a loss, but it would not bode well for his career going forward if that happens. But we'll see how it goes for Hopper, because like you said, at one point in time, he looked just like he was going to be the next contender for a heavyweight title. And then all of a sudden, he makes a move in camp for one reason or another, and obviously we know why. If you look at Rousey's finger on Instagram with that diamond on it, he put a ring on it. It is not bode well for him. So we'll see how this turns out. Now, that's UFC 213 pretty much in a bundle. There's some other fights on there, but I wanted to talk about the main ones with the main fighters in there that we'd be paying the most attention to. Let's talk some news outside the cage here real quick, Leo. Justine Keach was offered $15,000 by a UFC fan for her soiled shirt after her match with Felice Herring. We talked about on last week's show the unfortunate accident, but somebody's willing to pay $15,000. Leo, what the hell is wrong with some people?
Man, this is something like, you know, buy Britney Spears' half-eaten toast, you know, that I got out of the trash for $15,000. This is crazy. This is the first time hearing about this. I cannot believe somebody's willing to pay, you know, that incredible amount of money for something so disgusting. But, man, to each their own, I guess. I mean, there's crazy people out there willing to pay for things like that. I guess maybe that they think it's some kind of a memento of sorts or like a UFC history type of thing, because people are going to be talking about it for a while. But I don't know that I would want to pay anything at all for something like that.
They just go to show me that we got some sick, and I mean sick, not only physically, but mentally ill people out there in this world. It is just totally disgusting that somebody would be willing to do that. Ugh, nasty.
Now, if you're Justine Keach, do you actually go in and sell it, or do you just kind of scoff at that idea?
Well, you know, I mean, look, $15,000 is $15,000, and she didn't get the win with Reebok in there. She can't get sponsors. And, you know, no disrespect to her, she's not of a name to where, you know, she's getting those major fights in the future. So I'll be honest. I think I might have to take a serious consideration about that. $15K would do nice to pay a couple bills around here. So $15K isn't that bad.
I don't know if she still has that. She probably threw it away at this point. But, hey, I mean, just throw some chocolate pudding and some syrup on some new shorts and send them those. You're never going to know the difference, so.
That is true. I mean, you saw what Dave Chappelle did on his skit. Take a melted Snickers bar, good as gold.
There you
Leo, former UFC middleweight champion and definite Hall of Famer Rich Franklin would consider a return to MMA for the right fight. Who's the right fight for Rich Franklin if Ace was to return to the octagon or to the cage at least?
See, this is something I've not thought of very much. Let's see. I mean, there's people out there in Bellator for him. You know, Bellator, like we've talked about time and again, you know, they're kind of offering themselves as this haven for these former UFC guys who just want to continue their careers. It's weird to see that Rich Franklin wants to make a comeback. I think he's been involved with one championship, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm wondering if he's thinking of a comeback there in Asia, or if he's a free agent, or maybe he wants to make a UFC return. I don't know that I'd really be interested in seeing Rich Franklin at this point, but, I mean, we've seen crazier things. Chuck Liddell's talking about making a comeback. I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing that fight between those two guys at 205. So we'll see what how everything develops out from here.
Yeah, definitely. That would be interesting. And, again, If he was to come back, I'd want him to do the same matchups that Chuck Liddell potentially would have. The older fighters, you know, Silva, Sonnen, Liddell, you know, those fights. I don't want to see him in there against younger guys. There's no need for it. We'll see if Ace decides to come back to fighting or not. Your boy, your favorite fighter, Nick Diaz, informed by USADA of an anti-doping violation. Apparently, he's missed 3 whereabouts with USADA in a 12-month period. One of the rules with USADA is you have to let them know where you're going to be at all times for X amount of days. And if you miss 3, if they try to catch you for testing and you miss 3 of them because you didn't tell them where you were at, you could definitely be suspended. For Nick Diaz, he hasn't fought since 2015. I don't know. Like, he doesn't really sound like he's interested in fighting anymore, which I could totally understand and respect. Is Nick Diaz done with fighting, or is he just can't get right?
See, I wish Nick would just kind of come right out and say it. You know, I'm either retired or I'm an active fighter, or, you know, I'm waiting for the big fight. But he's just kind of throwing out all these you know, question marks out there. So we don't really know if Nick Diaz is an active fighter. Now, if he's inactive, then, you know, he's totally right to send USADA, you know, to hell. Because, you know, why does he got to tell him where he's going if he's not fighting any time, you know, in the near future? So, you know, I'm not a big proponent of, you know, these guys telling USADA where they are at all moments of their life. You know, it's kind of an invasion of privacy, which these guys did not sign up for. It was just kind of imposed on them. But like I said, Nick Diaz, he hasn't been active in a few years. So what's the point of him really checking in with USADA if he doesn't have any fights booked, especially, you know? So I wish we'd just get a little bit more clarity if the UFC would tell us, you know, Nick is, you know, in retirement, or we, you know, we're going to book him next week or something like that. But we're really just kind of wondering in the dark here. You know, I don't know what's going on with Nick Diaz. So, you know, I hope he doesn't get suspended and that, you know, that's the end of his career. But what can he really do with this guy who's unwilling to take any fights at any weight division, really?
Nick Diaz just needs to come out and just say what his intentions are. Does he plan to fight, or does he plan to just retire and not fight anymore? I think he really needs to come out and figure that out. Or if he wants to fight, would he rather do it away from the UFC where he's not fighting under the Reebok deal so he could get more sponsorships and more dollars potentially in Bellator? We'll see, but I definitely think he needs to clear it up. Last but not least here before we wrap up the show, Leo, there's a video that came out of Chris Cyborg sparring in a match against 2-time Olympic gold medalist Clarissa Shields. And look, it wasn't a one-sided ass whooping, but Clarissa Shields, being a 2-time Olympic gold medalist, showed Cyborg can be tagged standing up. But again, this is from a 2-time Olympic gold medalist, someone who went 78-1 as an amateur, 3-0 as a professional. Megan Anderson, a potential opponent for Cyborg in the future for the 145-pound title, says she's gained confidence after seeing that video. How confident should Megan Anderson be after seeing Cyborg get done up by a 2-time Olympic gold medalist?
I mean, I think it just shows that nobody's really invincible. You know, there's people out there who have holes in their games. It's just a matter of who can expose them and how. Now, as far as you know, training footage out there of Chris Cyborg, it's kind of apples and oranges. I mean, she's, like you said, she's going up against an elite level striker. And, you know, not that Cyborg is not that herself, but, you know, like we've seen her up against, you know, like Urena Barnes when she had that Muay Thai fight. She kind of looked a little bit more human, and that's because Urena Barnes is just the absolute elite of the elite in women's Muay Thai. So I don't really put too much stock in the training footage that gets leaked out there. But, yeah, if you're Megan Anderson, why not take a little bit of encouragement from that? And like we said, it might have been a silver lining in disguise for Megan Anderson to get the fight delayed, because then now she has a little bit more time to get prepared for someone like Chris Cyborg.
No, you could definitely take something away from it. But if you remember when Cyborg had that kickboxing or Muay Thai fight and she lost to the undefeated champion, everyone was saying, oh, look what happened. See, I told you, she's not invincible. Or as the trainer Rocky IV said, you see, he's not a machine. He's a man.
Right.
And we thought, oh, man, we're going to see a Cyborg just doesn't have it anymore. And what has she done since she's come back to MMA? She has been a monster. So there is something to take away just from the fact that, okay, if I just work on my stand-up, be more aggressive, work on my combos and my head movement, yeah, I can have some success. But it's totally different when you're an MMA fighter with no professional boxing background as opposed to a two-time Olympic gold medalist. I mean, this is the best of the best. So I would say there's something to take away from it, but I wouldn't put all my eggs in that basket there. I would certainly still continue to work on my game, get stronger, fix my cardio, and work on my my defense as well as far as slipping, moving around, and counter-punching, because we know Cyborg is going to come at you hard, strong, and vicious. So there's something to take away from it, but I wouldn't say there's much. I would say, if anything, that's like number six or seven on the list of what I could do going into my potential future fight against Cyborg going out. Well, Leo, that's pretty much the show. Great show as always. We've got some good fights coming out. We got the Hall of Fame ceremony. Sakuraba, the Gracie Killer, the legend, going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. We got the Ultimate Fighter finale, Johnson, Gaethje, Nunez, Chervenko, Romero, Whitaker. Oh, man, this is going to be International Fight Week. Not as big as before, but definitely going to be a good one. Any final thoughts before we call it in, brother?
No, you just mentioned it right there, Sakuraba being inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame. I'm really excited. This guy has been an absolute legend throughout his career, so I'm really happy that he's going to be honored this weekend, and I can't wait to go out there and see him. And, hey, if we get to meet Sakuraba, I'll die a happy man.
Sakuraba is one of the very few Pride guys that I would give the utmost total respect to and not call him overrated because he was allowed to use Mexican supplements over there. One of the very few guys to have, in fact, the only guy to have that many victories over that many members of the Gracie family. Got to have nothing but respect to the man himself right there. Anyways, guys, that's the show. Be sure to tune in every single Wednesday between 4 and 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time for Inside the Octagon. Also, check out the show on All Things Sports on Facebook. Leo, let them know where your Twitter handle is.
Follow me at ShowerLeo on Twitter.
There you go. And I'm at KLua11. That's KLUA11. Until next time, everybody, enjoy the fight. Talk to you later. Peace.
Got everything. I got everything. I cannot complain, I cannot. I don't even know how much I really made. I forgot, it's a lie. Fuck that, never mind what I got. Nigga, don't watch that, cause I came up, that's all me. Stay true, that's all me. No help, that's all me. All me, for real. Came up, that's all me. Stay true, that's all me. No help, that's all me. All me for
money
real.
Money on my mind, you should think the same. J's on, yeah. Pinky ring. Dogging these hoes, I need quarantine. In the same league, but we don't bow the same. Oh, she want all the fame. I hit her shit all the time.